And it really is an amazing, amazing job that we go through. Honestly, it is one of life roles that I think is such an incredible gift to us, that we get to have the opportunity to see a little life unfold and hopefully flourish before us into all the beautiful creative expressions of their person. And sometimes it's wonderful just to pause and reflect and remember that we get to do that job as parents. Now, we are a little bit low-tech here today at the cafe, and I wanted to show you two pictures this evening. So we're going to do that on the laptop, and Lou's going to show them to you. And the first picture... So hopefully you can see it on the screen. You might have to squint your eyes and strain a little bit. You'll get the general gist, hopefully, from afar. This piece down. Here we go. All right. So the first picture is of my three children, okay? And this is that one in a million moment where they are all simultaneously smiling and actually looking happy for a photo, okay? I know many of you know what that is like. The next picture is also my lovely little three-year-old daughter, straight after she had been found in my makeup bag and had found our new cream carpet as a lovely canvas for her artwork. And the reason I show you these pictures is really just to remind us that there is no such thing as perfect children and either as perfect parents. What we are dealing with is children. They are capable of the most extraordinary things one moment and the most exasperating things the next moment. And I bet there's many nods in your heart right now when you think about those moments in your own home. We're dealing with children. They are not just a mini adult in development, you know, like a little adult that just needs a bit of physiological growth. They are not yet fully developed in their brain, in their thinking, in their emotions, in their social development. In fact, a baby when it's born still has the whole sort of social brain that needs to be developed, actual cognitive matter, and the wiring of the social brain predominantly happens within the first 2 years of a child's life. So essentially, what we have is not just little mini adults when we're dealing with our children, but they have such a big journey of development and growth, just learning how to be loving, caring, social, and reasonable humans to other people. And I just think as parents, the first thing I want to say is that we need to learn just to laugh a little more, to worry a little bit less. We need to learn to slow down a whole bunch more. I think we overschedule so much in our lives. And we also need to learn to not take ourselves so seriously. And I think that might just help us a little bit to be great role models to what it is to be human, for the little children that we are trying to nurture. So this evening we are talking about developing emotional resiliency in children, and the potential for flourishing lies in all of our children. How they will express that we know will be different. Different personalities, different expressions of what flourishing looks like for them as people. However, the thing that we can't change is the challenges that they will face. That's something that we cannot avoid. But if we can help them to develop the skills to sort of face through those challenges, work their way through those challenges as best as they can, then that is exactly what resiliency is all about, is helping our children to learn the kinds of skills that help them to process through difficulty, uncertainty that comes across our paths as human beings. Now, I'd like to just first start by taking a closer look at what resiliency is, okay? It's not something we have or we don't have. It's a skill that we develop, or our children will develop as they grow. And they get that predominantly through their relationship with us. It's not something they're born with or not born with. It's not sort of what they're blessed in the richness of their genetic code. In any gene that, you know, in any cell that is operating, there's only a fraction of the genes that are operating. And those genes that are turned on in the moment are only those that are really stimulated by the environment around them. Resiliency is about nurture. It's not so much about nature. It's not what you're born with, but it's how the environment within which, into which, nurtures your ability to develop the skills to face difficulty, positive and healthy and adaptive. And the foundation 4, resiliency, is the relationship, a nurturing and a caring relational space that children can have, where they can learn a little bit more about the world, a little bit more about others, a little bit more about themselves, and they can learn how to process through the experiences that they are going through in kind of a safe and holding relational space. And this is what gives children resilience, which is essentially the ability to bounce back, you know, in the face of difficulty, uncertainty, and hard as trauma and bereavement and loss, even just natural stress and anxiety. So it's the ability for the children to bounce back, and that's what we call resiliency, and they have that and are able to do that if they have learned the skills to do so. Now, what's interesting is that resilient children tend to be more curious, right? They tend to be a little bit more okay with taking these out. And that's only because they've grown in their confidence to approach things that are uncertain, that they're not so sure about new situations in their life, because they've developed the skills to do so. And so we find resilient kids generally can be a lot more curious and a lot more able and willing to take those kinds of healthy risks in life. And what's really interesting is that some of the work I even do with adults is helping adults and helping us sometimes learn how to be resilient, have the skills to process through some of the stresses and difficult experiences that we might be going through. So what's going on physiologically? I thought I'd start with that a little bit, just to get us an idea so that we can orient ourselves around the kind of external relational stuff that we're going to be doing. When you're faced with a threat, what happens is that our amazing bodies activate this kind of stress response. It's like an emergency response system. And what it does is it sort of helps us to be stronger, more alert, faster, a more capable version of ourselves, so that we can kind of respond to the threat that's happening in the moment. And it's not meant to sort of last for a long period of time. It's kind of a response that helps you deal with the threat, and then hopefully that's enough and your body can kind of go back to normal. Things like your heart begins to beat faster and blood begins to get quicker and quicker around the extremities of your body so that you can act and be more agile in situations. So that's kind of what happens. And really, the part of the brain is the amygdala. Some of you might have heard of that. And hopefully I'm not boring those of you who are not so keen on this sort of physiological side underneath. But I think it's important for us to understand it, because then we can learn how to help our own children, and we can recognize what's going on with them. So the amygdala kind of activates that response. It perceives stress, bam. And then what it does is it begins to send out the message to release more sort of hormones, things that wouldn't be a surprise, like adrenaline. It gets released, and then the other one is cortisol. And the reason for that is it fuels this kind of fight or flight response in the situation that we're going through. And it's okay in the short term because it helps us to respond, but when stress or that threat remains imminent continuously, so that kind of stress response in our bodies stays switched on. Okay? And this can be a little bit unhealthy and unhelpful for us ongoingly. And which is interesting in a context like ours, is where I think, where I see anxiety levels are so high. And what happens when this system stays on for long enough, what happens is it affects our immune system, because it suppresses our immune system, also suppresses our immune system. And interestingly enough, you know, we see when students are writing exams, they get sick during exams, just after exams, it's that sustained level of stress and anxiety, and our body immune systems are low. It affects our brain functioning, our ability to focus, and also just physically our body is impacted by it. The other thing that's happening, so you've got this kind of stress response, hyper alertness that goes on. Then there's another part of your brain that actually, when the stress is big enough, and usually this can be secondary depending on the level of threat coming against or perceived kind of difficulty that one might be experiencing ourselves or our children. What happens is that the prefrontal cortex, which is located just sort of somewhere around about here, can be switched off often during those times. And why this is important, and that's important to understand, is that it's the part of the brain that is kind of like the control center of our people, you know, of us as people. It has all the executive functions that are triggered from this part of the brain or controlled. Basically, it's things like being able to attend actually to what is going on, to recognize what's going on, to be able to process, problem solve, to be able to regulate our emotions, you know, in the situation, and also to be able to control impulses. Where the amygdala is the kind of trigger of instinctive reactions that help us to snap into gear. The prefrontal cortex is the one that helps us to control those so that they, you know, through what we process, we respond in appropriate ways. And the interesting thing is here is that it can be helpful to sort of circumvent, you know, when there's this fight or flight kind of response. But sometimes it's really important to be able to try and pull back a little bit to calm the stress response and to be able to engage our processing of the situation, okay, in order to respond a little bit more appropriately. And that's essentially what resiliency is all about. It's about helping to calm that kind of stress response that we experience, but it's also about helping to sort of stay engaged with that processing part so that we can help to assess the situations that we are going through and begin to think about them and problem solve through them more appropriately. This is what resiliency is and how there are strategies that we can use to enable our children to be able to do these things, to be able to look at the situation that they perceive as stressful, to be able to adopt some strategies that are calming, that help us to process more holistically, more adaptively, more healthily, and to sort of pull back that stress response so that we can face difficulty and make our way through it. And this is essentially what developing resiliency is all about. I think it's very important also to note that it's our perceived stress or our perception of stress that will trigger the stress response. And that perception of stress that we have, it comes from, or that our children might have, comes from. Is everything okay? So what I was saying there is that it's our perception of stress that will trigger a stress response. So if we perceive something as stressful, then often our children pick up those cues from us. And this is why we often see anxiety runs little bits in family. The way in which we make assumptions about the situation, our children absorb that. And they too will assume in similar ways. So even although it may not be imminent threat, if they've been sort of cued to believe it is stressful, they will. And that will also trigger the stress response. And it depends on as much on the perception as it is on the actual real meaning, you know, the actual real trigger of the stress. All right. Now, children have different ways of showing that things are too much. And I thought maybe I would ask us tonight, many of you, well, hopefully I think most of you are parents and have children, that's why you're here this evening. What do you see as some of those cues, you know, in your children that the kind of... The demand on the outside is, you know, superseding their internal capacity to cope. In other words, when they're struggling and they're not really managing and it feels like they're not coping in a situation, it's all a little bit too much. What are some of the signals that you see in children, in your own, in others, that signal to you, hang on, something's going on here? Any thoughts? Anyone brave enough to give me a suggestion? What's it?
Well, on meltdowns.
Meltdowns.
Actually gone. On the floor, just pounding or banging their heads, just, and then sometimes actually saying, "I'm just so tired, or I can't cope, I can't stop crying."
Amazing, amazing that they can recognize I'm tired, I can't keep going. But yes, absolute strong emotional expression, meltdowns, really big one. Any others?
My is just quite weepy,
emotional, just
very emotional now.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. So emotional, excessive expressions, natural, just overload of emotional expression. Any others? Yeah?
Not being able to sleep.
Not being able to sleep, absolutely. And is that a previous pattern or is that a new pattern?
Up and down.
An up and down pattern, okay. Great. Yeah, not being able to sleep. So just the normal things of life become difficult.
Tummy ache.
Absolutely, yeah. Psychosomatic expressions. I am so glad that you have mentioned that, because children express themselves, they pick it up more on a physiological level than they do on an emotional level. conventional meal. And interestingly, different cultures, I've worked in different cultural settings, this is the case in some cultures too, where emotions are suppressed, but physical illnesses are okay and not so taboo, so people express their needs. Any other ones? Laughing at that.
Hitting, biting.
So anger and frustration outward, acting outwards. Okay. Yes. So all these things would be in different children, would express it in different ways. But really, another one I would maybe throw into the mix is regression. That's what I was asking about sleep. Is that a new pattern, old pattern? Basically, where a child has mastered a certain kind of developmental milestone, let's call it, or a type of skill, where they've mastered that skill, they then begin to not be able to get, or it feels like there's a disruption. Exactly. So bedwetting is a really good example. They've been sleeping through, and all of a sudden, they start school, they're in reception, and golly, they are starting to wet the bed in the night again. Or they're going to a new class, it's the beginning of the year, and there's this behavior that's sort of re-emerging. And basically, really what that is all about is that children develop mastery in a skill and they grow. It's like they grow in confidence, they get this mastery, and they're able to sort of move to the next level. When they're experiencing too much stress in their immediate environment, things that were okay and that they felt okay and able to, they often regress and fall back in their ability to do that, because just managing the simple things becomes difficult because their internal world is a little bit overwhelmed by stress. So seeing a change in behavior, in sleep, in eating, in bedwetting, and that something is a little bit too stressful in their environment. So basically what we are looking for is a shift from their usual behavior. And it's not just sort of a once-off shift. We all have our bad days and we want to have a meltdown. And children are the same, but it's where we begin to see a pattern in a change of behavior that feels, you know, like it's negative, or, you know, we're worried about it. And so we're looking for a change in behavior, a shift from a normal pattern, and a shift from a normal behavior, and also, are there any patterns that begin to see, is this an ongoing thing? Recently I had a conversation with a parent whose child has just started year three in a very competitive, very large new school. This child hasn't, and 8-9 years old now, hasn't had a tantrum since about the age of 4, or an emotional meltdown over the last 5 weeks, has been having several of these a week. So for me, immediate aha, what's going on with this child? What's new in their life? What's changed? What is happening in its relational and environmental world to tell me that there's too much stress for their ability to cope? So they are expressing it in different ways. I just want to say, all behavior is communication. Children communicate through their behaviors. They tell them, when children act out, it's because they're feeling it on the inside. And it's not so much asking the question, what on earth is wrong with this child? It's asking the question, what on earth has happened to this child? What are they going through? What have they experienced? And I do want to say that it's always important to just think about your children's behaviors and reflect them. If you see a marked change in behavior, recently I was with a parent whose child had a marked change in their behavior. They were like just doing inappropriate things at home and acting out with their siblings and just being rough and angry and saying things, like talking gruffly in a way that didn't usually. And we began to talk about it and was a little bit uncertain, asking what happened to this child. And it turned out that there was a parent who had been in the school that had, you know, hadn't done anything damaging to the child, but had been in the school in the classroom setting and had just been a little bit inappropriate in their interactions with the child, and this child was struggling to process it. So I want to say to you, be aware of your children's behaviors, be aware how they present, and where there's changes and you see patterns, ask yourself the question, how are you doing that? You know, what's going on? You know, is there anything you're feeling a little unsure about? How are your friendships going at school? And just being in that place of being a little aware of how those behaviors might shift. Okay, so that is just looking a little bit about how children might begin to demonstrate that they are not coping in an environment. Okay, so let's look quickly at developing, not quickly, but we'll spend most of our time now, it's looking at developing the resiliency in children. Okay. So the first and the foremost, and I'm going to spend a bit of time on this one because it is the foundation, it is fundamental, and it is primary if we are going to really have resilient children, and that is building a sound and a good emotional connection with your children. I don't know how to say it more passionately and more desperately. We need to know our children's hearts. We need to be connected to the emotional world. So we need to be in touch with them. It's not just about providing for their physical needs, but it's about being connected to who they are as little people. And relationships are the most important thing in a child's world. Full stop. I often hear, you know, it being said, oh, I'm going to send my child to nursery so they can learn social skills. It's not true. Children learn their social skills from you and me. That social brain is developed through their relationship with their primary carers. We model it. They exercise them and they practice them in their worlds out there. But they learn them in the safe, nurturing, not anxious space of their relationships with us. We teach them how to engage and relate socially and emotionally with others. So relationships are the most important experience in your child's environment. They teach them about the world, you know, our relationship with them, give them clues and nudges and hints about what the world is like out there, about what people are like out there, and also what they are like. They mirror their image of who they are from how we talk about them, talk to them, and the words we express about them and internalize as their own self-image, the concept they have of their person. So nurturing a really strong emotional bond and connection is really important. It also gives them the opportunity to see us model the various skills that build resiliency, which we're going to talk a little bit about. Many studies, time and time again, have shown us that it is the supportive and caring relationships that children have within their families and outside of their families that are a primary resiliency factor. It's like any research study on resiliency will show you that the relationships, caring ones and nurturing ones and supportive ones in the family and also out, are really important for the resiliency that children have. So also having connection with grandparents and extended family or good family friends or communities where you might have social groups or faith groups that you're part of, where they can be really nurturing relationships, are really important for children. And it's interesting because over the last decade, there's been so much prolific research in the field of neuroscience, attachment science, you know, clinical psychology, and the key message that's come in this research over the last decade that we sort of pull out and synthesize what's really been going on. And it may feel like a no-brainer to many of you, but it's what finally we've seen in the research, which is essentially this, that we are social and relational beings, and that human beings are first and foremost social and relational beings. And what that means is that you and I and our children, just as much, are hardwired for connection, for a deep emotional connection, where a sense of our hearts can be known, where a sense of comfort and reassurance can be reliably obtained. And that's what we are hardwired for as human beings, and our children just the same. And what happens is that we see, the research shows us that when we do receive that comfort and that reassurance in those relationships, it actually calms that stress response. The stress response we were talking about earlier, it has a calming effect on that and helps us to process and deal and be that much more resilient in the face of stress. And the first place that children experience that deep connection of soul is with, often, us as their parents, or those who are the primary caregivers. Now, research with children who work with babies under the age of 2 has also shown, I have some books here which I'll pop out afterwards that you can come and have a look at that talk a lot to what I'm speaking today. But research that sort of merges attachment theory and neuroscience shows us that in the first 2 years of a child's life, and obviously ongoingly, the most sort of important protective factor for emotional well-being in a child is having an emotionally responsive adult. So it's not just the presence of an adult and the constant presence of an adult. It's kind of an adult who can engage and understand and be sort of sensitive to the emotional nuances that child is going through. So it's really such a fundamental part of our development as humans, is having that emotional connection, having that emotional sensitivity from those who are caring for us. I have a friend who is currently doing some big research with Syrian children in refugee camps. And they've just had some preliminary data results come out of their data in this research. And amazingly, the two significant resiliency factors for these children under such stress and trauma is, again, it's parental acceptance and parental involvement. And really what that is the sort of positive emotional connection of a parent and the kind of engaged, involved parent in the day-to-day of the child in these refugee camps is a big resiliency factor in their ability to cope with the stress of their environment and what they have been through. So, should we maybe mention just a few practical tips on how we can develop some of that emotional, those emotionally close or connected relationships? So the first one is be emotionally present with your child. Just, you know, so often we're there, but we're not there. We're over there, and the to-do list is like about 10 things long, right? And you're like, I've got to cook dinner, I've got to run the bath, I've got to get you to bed, then I've got to get up. And I think the important thing is to be in the moment. This is why mindfulness has been such a sort of a great addition to the field of psychology, because it helps us to be grounded in what's going on in the moment. And we can so often be future-oriented in our thinking, like, what's the next thing? Where am I going? I'm here, I'm doing this, but I'm not really doing it, because I'm doing it with everything I need to do in mind. And the point is to try and find ways in which you can sort of put aside your to-do or write it down so it's out the way, or look at ways in which you can... Anxiety will affect our present thinking, by the way, because it draws us away into worry, which is a type of sort of faulty problem-solving mechanism. But we need to think a little bit about how I can be emotionally present, and sometimes just grounding ourselves and saying, maybe you've got, you know, you can wear a wristband, or if it's a particular problem, something that's a reminder for you, be present, you know, and or little reminders for you on your phone that you know, maybe you'll put a 5 minutes aside where you are present with your child and you engage with them, and so that you're not in a faraway land while you are with them. Hurry less, be with them more, you won't regret it. But if you don't, in a few years' time, you'll wish you had, while they still want to spend time with you, right? Spend one-on-one time with your kids. It's so valuable. It sends them the message that you are important to me. Find those moments to get that one-on-one time where you take them out or you happen to have them home, whatever it is. But it's really such an important thing where we put down our smartphones and we give our children undivided attention, where they are singled out, particularly if they're siblings, that they are important to us. And that they are important enough for us to put down our phone and put down the agenda, and everybody else in our life is competing for our attention, and focus on them. It's really such an important thing. Play is also such a great relationship builder. The play is a child's world of work. It is the work of a child. It's what they do to process their feelings, to work out what's going on, to figure out what's going on in the world. And it's a really important that it's really helpful, rather, to build a kind of closer connection with them by getting down on the floor and playing with them, or getting outside with a football or a tennis racket, or going for a cycle, where you begin to do something together with them that is their enjoyment. It also helps us to learn a little bit more about them about us, and about themselves and how they fit into the world, that they are seen, they are known, and that they are important. I also think including children in what we're doing on the go is really important, whether it's the cooking, whether it's unpacking the dishwasher. You might need to use a little bit of smart language there and make it fun if it seems like a joke. But include children in what you are doing. We do a disservice to our children when we do all the things for them. Because actually, parenthood is about preparing children to be independent in the world. And when you go into adolescence, the biggest kind of conflict of an adolescent or an emerging adolescent is, I want to be independent and do this by myself, but I'm quite kind, I need you, mommy, but no. And they're kind of backing and forcing, trying to figure out where they belong and if they can actually do this okay. And we enable our children when we create opportunities for them to be independent and learn how to do things that independent adults do. And it's not so much as giving them the task and demanding them do it, but doing it with them and making it kind of an experience as well for bonding, and hopefully giving them the opportunities to carry it on themselves. I often have to remind myself in this, of the motto, sort of happy hearts and messy home or messy floor, you know, if we're doing some cooking task together, and it's okay to have a messy floor because I'm going to have happy hearts. And it's hard sometimes because we need to remember that the journey is as important as the outcome. The journey of togetherness and enabling our children is as important as the outcome of getting that cake baked, that dinner in the oven, or whatever the task is at hand. I want to mention something called also rough and tumble. Now, many of us will know that this is a great way for dads to be involved. Not as intuitive sometimes as moms, but really a lot of fun if you can get yourself into it. But rough and tumble is really such an important sensory and bonding experience for children. And interestingly enough, there's therapeutic methods that use for disconnected families, use rough and tumble as a mode of regaining that sense of connection and bonding with children and their fathers. And even in primary schools, there are some cases where they use rough and tumble just to help exert some physical energy and sort of bring a sensory settling back into some children so that they can focus again on the tasks at hand. And there's so many benefits to it, from you know closeness, fun, positive hormones, seeing that sort of laughter and enjoyment in the family of one another. But some other different things we might not think about, but things like turn-taking and learning sensitivity to others is something that dads can often role model in those kind of encounters. So a really fun way, but also a really significant way. Bedtime. Just a note on bedtime. A really important connection point for our children, not just a task to get through at the end of the day, which can be hard, right? And it's been a long day. But bedtime is one of the most significant connection times for children. Many of you will know that at the end of the day, sometimes you're lying in bed and there's a sort of sense of reflectiveness that we have as people. Where there was a little unresolved conflict or an unresolved experience we might have had sort of flickers back to our mind, if we will allow ourselves the self-awareness and the opportunity to reflect back up, you know, be open to those things. That is similar for children. They feel a little bit more reflective and open to sort of looking back at their day as they're dwindling off to sleep. And things might pop up and you're like, oh, quiet, but I need you to sleep. But actually, it's important to what they might have to say. And also, give a little space before bedtime, at bedtime, to connect with your child. It's when they're reflective. And the older they get, this is so important. To early adolescents and adolescents, use it as an opportunity to check in with your child. One of the things I think is helpful to ask, especially as your kids get older, and say, was there anything you were a little unsure about in your day today? If you haven't had much time and you need a little go-to question, that's a good one. You just want to check. You know, was there that experience in the playground that left them feeling a bit insecure about themselves? Was there that teacher's remark that made them worry about whether they're actually okay? And you want to just have anything you felt a little unsure about today or made you, you know, unsure about. And also think it's helpful to focus on the positive and say anything you feel thankful about your day today. Some people do some sort of thankful mindfulness task where you sort of begin to think about your day and try and find all the kind of thankful thoughts that you might have. I think it's a really healthy exercise to create a sense of reflection and just awareness for children. It's a really important skill for resiliency. What are the difficulties? And what are maybe some of the positives? All right, so that was kind of all around nurturing this emotional bond. Another important one.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about rough and tumble, what sort of activities do you like chase?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good one. I bet there's some answers in this room. Anybody want to, I'll happily answer, but I wonder if anyone's got some cool ideas for me. Anyway. Ivy tackle, that sounds brilliant. And who's worse off, you or him? Yeah, so I guess looking for opportunities for sort of physical play, you know, like, could seem a bit masculine, but girls and boys, surprisingly, it is so significant. And research has shown, isn't this interesting, that girls that have engaged in rough and tumble with their dad are more popular in the playground. Not that that's something that we want for children, but I feel slightly hesitant to even mention that. The point is here, I think they're a little bit more holding of their own in the playground and they can handle a little bit of what's going on. Perhaps maybe that's the better thing to be thinking about in popularity. Okay. So like engaging, whether it's like, you know, getting on the floor and piling on top of mum, maybe dad, I don't know, or, you know, just getting on top and tickling your children and rolling around the floor and any kind of sort of rough, fun, physical play, activity, chase, you know. And also can engage, you know, kids in teamwork, you know, kids versus parents, you know, and, you know, save them from the or chase around the house and sort of tumble all over. That kind of thing, I mean, if you can imagine what I'm talking about. I'm sure many of you have way better examples than that, but I've got the mic, so. Right. Nurture optimism. I want you to take a moment. So this is my another point around developing resiliency, is to nurture optimism in our children. Pause for me, please, if you will, and think of yourself. When you're faced with difficulty, uncertain situation, a little bit of stress, how do you tend to frame that? Is it half full, like positive framing around that? Or does it feel a little bit overwhelming, negative, I can't cope too much? Is it a little bit more of a negative framing? And the reason I won't ask you to answer those questions, but the reason I ask you to reflect is that the way we frame situations, whether it tends to be more positive or more negative, is very strongly related to resiliency. And children who are optimistic, optimistic children are so much more resilient. And it kind of makes sense, I suppose, if you think a little bit about it intuitively, because they're able to face uncertainty and begin to think a little bit about how they could be positive, not just doom and gloom in that situation. And if we go back to the point I made earlier about it's our perception of stress that triggers a stress response, can you imagine that if we tend to frame things more negatively, that it is possible that more often the stress response is triggered in situations. Does that make sense to you, what I'm saying there? And so it's not about squashing a pessimistic view. It's very important to acknowledge those pessimistic feelings, right? But then help show them another way. So for example, Johnny, I know that you're feeling so disappointed because we can't go to the park because of the rain. You know, I also feel disappointed when things that I'm really looking forward to don't happen. But how do you think we could make the most of this? Is there anything we could do on a rainy day that we wouldn't otherwise do indoors? And if they're not really buying it, get crazy. We could, you know, build a wild cave fort and, you know, I don't know, dress up like cavemen and have fun. I don't know. Get crazy. Think of silly options that engage their humor and help our children to begin to nurture that there is another possibility to think about a situation. Optimism and resiliency are very closely linked. And the idea is to help them focus a little bit more or as well on what is left, not just on what is lost. And it makes sense then too that children who have more optimistic views fare a little bit better in the face of change because they're able to process that change with the option of a more positive frame than a negative one. All right. Another thought is, a third one is to promote healthy risk taking. Now, we live in a city where there's a lot of health and safety. You know, we are often on roads, we don't have sort of free rein and endless boundaries. And what that means is that there is often the constraint of living within a city for children. And it constricts in many ways their adventuring. So it is something we really need to be aware of and try to nurture a little bit more healthy risk-taking or create opportunities for that. I remember when we arrived in South Africa once on a holiday, my three-year-old then sort of landed outside in a pale white British skin and she saw a little ant that was about 2 millimeters big and started screaming and was really scared and like ran away. And I was quite surprised to see the response. But the interesting thing was is that we sort of tried to help her with that. I mean, that was a testament of living in the city perhaps. But we tried to help a little bit with that and just nudge her a little bit more towards the sort of place of discomfort. And by the end of the holiday, she was collecting these little ants in a jar for observation and ant torture probably. But the point was, this is about helping our children to take sort of healthy steps, nudging them to take some sort of steps towards some healthy risk taking. And it's not about putting our children in harm's way. It's about risks towards something where the outcome, even if it fails, is really not going to do us too much harm. And it's about looking for opportunities to nudge them towards that. Like, for instance, trying a new sport, or maybe going up to say hi to that shy person in the playground that maybe doesn't have, you know, so many friends. It's nudging them beyond what is their comfort zone, but that results in very little harm. And we need to let them know that it takes so much courage and bravery to take those steps towards, you know, those new things or those uncertain things. Let's encourage them in the bravery that they are displaying, and that bravery is even more important than the outcome, so that we can teach them that trying new things, taking new things, and when they face challenges, that they can respond to it and have the confidence to do so. Let's say, for example, you have a child who's feeling a little bit afraid to swim. Take that, it could be anything, but let's say, for example, they're struggling and they're really upset, don't want to go near the water and swim. I would encourage that we begin to nudge them slowly towards it, graduate their exposure towards you know, the water. And this is something called systematic desensitization, but we can do it with our kids. It's basically just gradual exposure to the thing that feels a little bit scary to them. So you might just say, hey, I heard that there was a new elephant sign at the leisure center. Should we go and pop our heads in and see what that's like? You know, let them just go see the swimming pool area. You know, maybe as they feel confident and secure at that stage, we then prompt them and nudge them a little bit more. And we say, how about we go in the swimming pool? Sophie, your little friend at school, is doing, you know, swimming today. Should we go in and watch it for 5 minutes and see what it's like? And then you go, you're encouraging all the way, and you expose them to that. And you do that often enough until they feel secure at that place. And then you introduce the next thing. Put on their swimming suits and get them closer to the water and say, let's just go sit in our swimming suits today, and we're going to watch the kids. And next time, you know, when they're secure there, we might, why don't we dip our feet in the water? You get the point. Is that it's a gradual exposure, and it's a really good thing to help our children learn how to face challenges and new things in a way that's healthy and appropriate. When kids avoid risk, they internalize the message that they aren't strong enough to face challenges. But when we affirm their courage and their bravery, when they are faced with a challenge, they feel that much more confident and competent to try their hand at working their way through that challenge. Does that make sense? All right. Another one, let's teach problem-solving skills. So resiliency is really about learning skills, which are learned within a relational context, right? And we can teach those problem-solving skills. And often our gut reaction can be to jump in and solve the problem for our children, but it's really helpful. Sibling difficulties is a big one. Sometimes our discomfort from the sibling difficulty wants to squash that straight away, right? But I see this so often, but it's really important to allow our children the opportunity to go and figure out the problem that they're going through. It's not about sort of leaving them to it and sort of not being any support at all. Really what it's about is, instead of problem solving for them, it's problem solving with them. And a good way to engage in that process is to begin by asking questions. So instead of just bringing in and saying, well, listen, just leave your brother alone, and you play with that, and you play with that, and that's the end of that, or whatever it is, you know. You help them. It's a little bit more time consuming. It requires a bit of patience, maybe a cup of coffee in the afternoon. And help them to learn those skills. So let's take an example here. You've got Susie comes to you and says, Mummy, I'm trying to play with George, but his little baby brother, Joseph, keeps getting in the way of our game. All right. And, you know, we could think of a few things we might want to problem solve at that moment. Perhaps what we could do is begin to ask questions and say, well, what game are you playing, and what's going on? Oh, we'll be playing da-da-da-da this game, and okay, and so what's going on with the game, etc. And what comes out is, oh, so it sounds to me like it feels like little Joseph, you don't feel like little Joseph is able to play in your sort of bigger boy games. Okay. Well, what do you think Joseph feels about that? And ask him the question, you know, to sort of problem solve what's going on there. Well, maybe he feels a little bit, I don't know, maybe it's left out. Maybe he feels bored and he's looking for some fun, and you might help them to figure that out a little bit by asking some questions. And then put it to them and say, well, I think you could figure out a way that you might be able to help Joseph feel a little bit better about the play date whilst you're still able to play with Susie or Sally or whoever it was that the play date was with. So the point is, begin by asking questions and put it to the child. Sometimes they can be leading questions when you sort of know the answers, just to help them try and figure it out themselves. Again, the thing with teaching problem-solving kids, problem-solving, is that it gives them the opportunity to know that they can face a problem, and they don't feel weak in the face of problems, and they feel empowered as if they've got the skills to know how to face a difficulty or a problem. Some things you could ask is, come up with a list of ideas. It could be another problem. So, well, come up with a list of ideas. What's worked before? Or shoot me, what you do in this incident, even if it's so silly and crazy. You know, you could make it a fun game and just give them the opportunity to problem solve. Another thing is you can say, well, how could we break this big problem up into small little pieces? And give them the opportunity to think about it in a new way and maybe figure it out for themselves. All right. I'll maybe mention the next two, and then I'll just sort of list up a few to you. I wonder if we're getting ready to have some question time. Label emotions. This is really important. This helps children to identify what they're feeling. If you can understand and figure out a little bit more what you're feeling, then you help able to understand that in itself is a validating experience. Oh, I can just see you feeling a little jealous that Susie got that new toy and you did it. And it's really helpful. It really validates them. Oh, that's what I feel. Just naming it and helping them to identify it helps us to figure out what's going on, but then also gives us an opportunity with more clarity to figure a way through that difficulty that they're experiencing. I do this work so much with adults now. It's just really trying to distill down to them what is it that you're feeling and why, and what is the impact that it's having on our life and our behavior. And when you see a behavior, interestingly, you say something like anger. Anger's a good one because it's a part of things. For resentment, for jealousy, for fear, it is a really good smokescreen for fear. Children feel angry because they're facing something and it makes them feel really unsure about themselves. So the thing is to almost like reject it and sort of project negatively onto it, and they can express it with anger. So it's important to understand what those feelings are, and we can help them figure their way through it. All right. Embrace their mistakes and yours. This is a good one. We live in what has been termed in Britain a success culture. In other words, there is an increasing obsession in the English-speaking world throughout the world, and particularly in Britain, to be the best, to achieve it, to be successful. It really is problematic and increasingly problematic in our British culture. And the worst hit by this culture that we are in is adolescent girls. 1 in 3 adolescent girls in the United Kingdom have emotional distress. 1 in 4 have a mental health disorder. 1 in 12 have an eating disorder, because perfection is what we are attained for, which is absolutely inhumane and unhuman. There is no such thing as the ability to achieve perfection. But when we have a results-based culture that we need to get the certain grades in order to make a certain school, we need to have certain things in order to, there's this outcome-based society where it's success or failure. Failure becomes seen as a taboo, and therefore the strive is towards always succeeding and this idea of perfectionism. And obviously we can tell that it's something that's really unhealthy. But if we can model our own mistakes, or be a little bit more vulnerable with our own difficulties and things that we mess up with our children, what happens when we mess up or we make mistakes is we normalize that actually humanity, even the things that I'm good at, I will make mistakes in. And there are some things that I'm better at than others. That's okay. And there are some things that even that I'm good at, that sometimes I'll make mistakes. It's part of my growing, and I can use it as an opportunity to learn. It doesn't dismiss the fact that sometimes it's hard, but it also creates the opportunity for us to normalize and enable our own children to accept the reality that failure is a part of life. We will mess up from time to time. Adolescent girls are the worst hit, and the thing we understand and we have come to see is because in the last sort of, 30 to 40 years, the role of women in society has changed. We've adopted into a new and increasing, you know, career level of opportunity and attainment, but it's also a sort of unintended consequence of increasing stress on our daughters. What's happening is that they feel the need to be successful as a, you know, doing well at school. They need to be physically beautiful. They need to be sportingly, you know, agile and have success in that area. But also they feel the immense pressure to be sort of have a social life and socially adept. And it's actually crushing the spirits of young girls. And the worst hit of that adolescent slice of girls, it's sort of 15 to 17 year old, is actually adolescent girls in private schools in the United Kingdom. I have some resources that I can share with you in that. All right, so.
What are the worst
things? I think it's an interesting question, but it links back to that success culture and the kind of need to achieve. Often, to get into some of the private schools in the UK, not all, but some, there are these entrance exams.
But beyond the private schools, what is that age group?
I think it's because it's coming into that age where they are identifying with this role called womanhood in a new kind of a way. And it's a natural developmental phase. Right, so they're identifying with womanhood, and there's this perception that there's career, there's social, there's what media and, you know, so much of what we see and the projection of what, I guess, a woman needs to be physically as well as on a working level and a social level. And it's also the time at which, I guess, emotions are really ripe. They've had the opportunity to really develop past the pre-adolescent phase. And it's emerging, it's kind of emerging womanhood. So whereas they might be shown levels of stress at the younger ages, that stress then develops into that place of being acknowledged and recognized as a mental health condition.
Can I just follow up on that? How do you practically cater against that? Because a little bit of self-esteem and resilience to all of that is a situation where they don't feel they have to do what everyone else does. How do you practically ward against that?
Yeah, it's such a good question, and I could answer it now. I wonder if, can you remind me of that question? Let me come to the end and I'll come back to it, because I think it's essentially what we're talking about today, but maybe there's a few specifics to highlight about that. So we can also, we need to embrace mistakes. Model resiliency is another one. Basically, imitation is the best form. If we can model those times when we've had to be resilient through disappointment or difficulty, uncertainty, our kids can learn what that's like for them. So let's say, for example, you didn't get the job that you were really hoping for. So maybe, and it's looking for kind of age-appropriate ways to share those emotions with them and maybe bring them a little bit more into your emotional world. So for example, actually, you know, Johnny, I do feel really disappointed that I didn't get that job today. You know, I was really hoping to get the job. And then you might want to say something like, it's really important to have things that we look forward to, isn't it? But you know what? I know I'll be okay. I can keep applying and I can keep trying, and I bet the right job is going to come along for me. So it's bringing our kids a little bit into the world, how we might process our own disappointment, maybe in a bit more of a simplified way, and helping them to see that we can make our way through that difficulty. All right, great. A last one to mention is just our own self-care skills. The more we attend to our emotional goals and our own personal resiliency, the more we are able to do it with our children. And the last thing I want to mention today, and then I'll come to some questions, is just the point about how our modern world, and I've kind of alluded to that, and it's the point you were speaking to, how our modern world is threatening the well-being of our families. The prevailing values of our culture influence some of our own personal values, and they do over time. And social studies show us that they start in sort of a middle-class spectrum and they move their way outwards. And the kind of prevailing values affect our own personal values and also some of the decision making we might do. And so it's really important to stop and pause and reflect on what are values around family life and the nurturing of children, and are they in any way affecting our family in a negative kind of way? positive is great, obviously, but we want to understand how it could be negatively unhealthy. All right, so Nelson Mandela, in his speech to launch the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund in 1995, which is a fund that looks at the well-being and resilience of children, he said this: there is no keener revelation of a society's soul than the way in which it treats its children. And in our current affluent societies, the English-speaking, westernized world, childhood is under threat, and so is parenthood and mothering in particular. It threatens the well-being of children. We spend a lot of time attending to children's material needs, exposing them to all the right kinds of things that they should learn and be, to be a whole, full, amazingly, you know, cultured young person, in comparison to attending sometimes to their developmental and emotional needs. Children are, in our society today, facing increasing pressure to grow up too soon, before they are developmentally ready to handle the challenges that that growing up brings. Pressure to perform, pressure to achieve, pressure to consume is a really, really big one. And be little adults. In a city like London, we feel surrounded by an environment of performers, producers, consumers, which is passed on to our children. And people live in higher than normal states of stress and exhaustion. And the areas most often affected, an area that can often be affected is the quality time that we then have as families, building relationships and connecting. Since 1998, the number of people in Britain working more than 60 hours has doubled. And full-time Brits work on average 40 hours a week, and we know it's the most in the EU. We work longer hours, travel greater distances, and it affects the resilience of our children in as much as it affects our emotional connections with them. Australian author and activist Stephen Biddulph, he has just been around for decades and written so much and been a real activist in parenting. Some of you might even have read his books. I think it's like number 2 on Amazon's hit list of parenting books. And he says this: anxiety seems to be the British disease, and the British family seems to be dying of stress. Some of the biggest life difficulties facing children's parents and families' well-being are no longer just conventionally the traumas and the bereavements and difficulties of old. It is the everyday threat of modern day life. And in Britain, we have particularly just gotten so busy. And living in a big city like London, we really know what that feels like. Mozart says this: love guards the heart from the abyss. The abyss is that feeling of aloneness in the world, disconnectedness. Psychologists will agree that one of the most distressing experiences highest up on the life threat indicator is the loss of an attachment partner. And what he's saying here is that love guards the heart from the abyss, that place of desperate aloneness in the world. Children need regular, meaningful connection that brings love and reassurance to their inner beings, not just their outside physical kinds of needs and their intellectual needs. And if our only way to achieve this for our children is to slow down and to spend more time with them, then we must. There's just no way around. And if our need to achieve and be successful is affecting the resilience of our children, and particularly our daughters, then we need to stop and think about what are the things that really make life worth living and orient our lives around it. The aim of parenting is connection, it's not control. Our generations of old had a really authoritarian parenting style, and it was a lot more about control than it was about connection. Not in all instances. Some of us might have had beautifully parented experiences. It's not just about nurturing the outside world, but the inside world too. It's about connecting in with your children's hearts. It's about developing a lifelong relationship with your child that is the soil from which they can flourish into life and develop the skills of resiliency. Great. That's enough, I think, said for me. So I'd love to take some questions. Lou can maybe guide us in the kind of time we might have for them.
We've got 5 minutes left, but we could just extend it and just say to if anyone needs to go earlier than the break, too.
All right. So you're suggesting that we've got maybe about 5 minutes left, but if anybody does need to go, I'm happy to take a few more questions. If you need to dash, please just do that. Welcome to stand up and sort of shuffle your way out. So perhaps we could start by taking the question at the back there. Remind me how you phrased the question around the gentleman.
You have all the time, don't you worry. I'm not working tomorrow, you can stay as long as you want. Don't worry.
So I think it really speaks to developing these resiliency skills. Some of them, the most primary is having that connection with your daughter, being able to recognize when they seem to be under duress and under stress, and helping to get into that world with them and understand what are the things that you're trying to process, what are the difficulties you're facing that feel overwhelming for you, and helping them learn the skills for problem solving. I think embracing mistakes, that it's okay to make a mistake, and helping them have a more holistic sense of their self. When I said earlier that perfection is not the goal, the alternative that for me is very significant, it's what we aim to enable people when they are on a therapeutic journey, is something called wholeness. Wholeness is about being integrated as a person. It's being able to look at yourself and say, you know what, I'm pretty good at these things, not so good at these things, but I'm okay with that. I recognize even in the things I'm good at, sometimes I'll make mistakes. I need to reflect on that, understand that, work through that disappointment perhaps, but know that I am ultimately okay. It's helping them learn that, you know, success doesn't define, failure doesn't cripple. And it's also an important thing is looking into the sort of, as they get older, that as adolescent space, it's looking into the friendship world of the girls, because they increasingly turn their attention from us, right, in some ways, and gain their sense of knowledge and perceptions and what they're learning about the world from their friends around them. So you could tell a lot about your daughter by examining and understanding some of the friends that they might be hanging out with. And it's important, if we can keep this connection, that we are kind of an unconditional positive regard, kind of a go-to for our children. If they can have that connection with us, that is their sort of ticket through, their key through those difficulties, so that they have sort of a reasonable voice of love to help sound them through the uncertainties, because they're picking up messages from the world all the time, right? About their physical, academic person. And so we can help nurture them through it if we can keep the connection, help them learn to problem solve, you know, recognize mistakes, etc. So going back to some of these things. And also labeling and identifying what they're feeling and being able to talk about it through. It's more of the same, essentially, right? Yeah.
Do you have any practical tips for how to deal with I can't, like, classically, I can't sleep. You know I can't sleep, like, I'm sort of like, we can, you just do it if you think. Like, but, but this is kind of like the worst thing you can say is I can't, but it seems to be trapped in this.
And have you sort of, that's really interesting. I'd want to understand why and perhaps what's going on for the person. Maybe want to understand what are some of the feelings going on behind them. Is, you know, I might ask him, you know, I just really want to understand what are the feelings going on behind the bedtime thing. Is it something about bedtime, or is it something about separation? Is there a fear element for them going on in this situation? So the first thing I might want to do is say, what makes you feel that you can't sleep? It's so difficult to sleep. And maybe just throw a few questions and ask them. They're trying to tease out what's going on for them in this concept of I can't, and is it particularly related to sleep, or is it particularly related to different, if it's kind of generalizable across their life, then I might, and they're feeling a little bit like I can't in a lot of scenarios, then maybe they've got this growing sense that I'm afraid to try, or I'm not sure about whether I am able enough to do it. In which case, I would want to sort of manufacture some experiences that would give them the opportunity to try things and experience some mastery and chaos. And then I would reflect that back, and I would want to help them to see the bravery, the courage of doing that, and then try to see if we can begin to translate that for them into, say, the bedtime experience. And then maybe you can look at that bedtime and say, well, what feels so hard about bedtime? If everything in the whole world could be different, what would help to make you sleep? Or, you know, you can always turn it on the other way around and say, if you could do anything in the world that could help you sleep, what would it be? You know, if there would be anything that you could help take you to bed, what would that be? You know, and maybe you could do some mirroring. I don't know how old your child is. 7. You know, I might be wondering, is there some anxiety? I don't know, there's lots of things to think about the icon. If there's some emotional difficulty, I would want to try probing and figure out, is there an emotional thing that's going on, and maybe there's some anxiety with difficulty around that. And if there's some anxiety about sleep because they feel they might not be able to, and it's sort of building up, then I'd want to put in place a little kind of step-by-step process on how we might get ourselves closer towards sleep. You know, for instance, you know, having a warm bath, having some cuddle time in bed, reading a story together, maybe mum or dad can sleep with you while you sleep, putting together some things that might provide the reassurance for them, and also dismantling it for them and saying, so what? You don't need to sleep. You just need to lie there and rest your eyes. I mean, I don't know how you might do it, but almost sort of take the thing that's a hard thing out of the way and say, don't worry, you don't need to sleep. You know, and almost sometimes we, you know, the fear thing, when that's removed, can take that some of that difficulty. Right. I mean, I'd be happy to have a conversation about a specific situation, but those would be some thoughts.
I just
happened
to say,
in
the past 3 weeks, she's gotten out to sleep. She literally had 3 weeks of she'd wake up at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. She's emotional, she's crying, she's just, she can't leave, she's 7, and it's like having a newborn. I just, you know, I've tried having a bed, I've tried everything. I've tried to spend a stick, you know, take things away, I've tried to be rewarding, and I just, I'm not completely lost.
Yeah. Yes, the first one is, you know, so what was it like before? Is this a shift in behavior?
This has been, yeah, I think since school started, it's changed slightly, but the past 3 years
ridiculous. She just, she honestly
believes she's
gone. Yeah, so I mean, the thing really going on in the back of my mind when I hear that is, wondering, has it, because there's a shift there, there's a shift in that sort of irregular pattern of behavior. So I'm wondering, what's happened to the child? What is she processing? And is there anything that she's trying to process that her sleep is being affected by? And, you know, I know school started in the last month, so what's going on there for her? And is there any anxiety around the teacher and around friendship? 7 is a really big age, sort of 6 to 11, friendships.